everyone, you're listening to The Progressive American, and this is our first episode of the year. As always, I'm your host, Connor Kelly. Welcome back to the show. It is January 15th, 2021. Today we are talking about Joe Biden's speech on January 6th, the Oath Keepers getting arrested, the RNC's plan to withdraw from the Presidential Debate Commission, and much more. With that out of the way, let's get into the news. In a historic speech, President Biden addressed the nation for the anniversary of the January 6th attack, warning that the men and women responsible for causing it were still active. Though not directly mentioning Trump, President Biden routinely condemned the former president, saying that he held, quote, a dagger at the throat of American democracy. Blaming Trump for inflaming the anger of his base and for claiming that the election was stolen, President Biden reminded Americans that Trump had not only failed to prove any of his claims in court, but that he put his duty aside at the expense of the country. In what could only be described as a clear condemnation of Trump's legacy and character, Biden said, quote, his bruised ego matters more to him than our democracy or our Constitution. He can't accept he lost. In response, Trump released a statement attacking Biden, saying, part of the Democratic panic is motivated by the realization that, just like the Russia collusion hoax, they cannot sustain the preposterous fabrications about January 6th much longer. The truth is coming out. Remember, I am not the one trying to undermine American democracy. I'm the one that's trying to save American democracy, end quote. This response from Trump is exactly the kind of nonsense that Biden should provoke more of. When dealing with the severity of something like January 6th, which saw multiple people dead and over 100 officers injured, provoking Trump like this could serve as a good reminder about the fundamentally shallow nature of the former president, but it also helps draw attention to the basic fact that Trump's conspiracy theories did lead to the attack on the Capitol. And it's worth noting that Biden is not the only president who has called out the Trumpist attack on our democracy, not just on January 6th, but in the legislatures that are motivated by that same lie. And it's also worth noting that Biden is not the only president who has called out the Trumpist attack on our democracy. Former President Jimmy Carter wrote a piece in the New York Times in which he warned that our democratic system is under attack thanks to these lies that Trump himself spread. In his article, former President Carter explained that, quote, I now fear that what we have fought so hard to achieve globally, the right to free, fair elections, unhindered by strongman politicians who seek nothing more than to grow their own power, has become increasingly fragile at home, unquote. So unless Trump and his allies are willing to go after Jimmy Carter and the other presidents who have condemned what happened last year, it's pretty hard to argue that the condemnation that they are receiving is purely partisan or purely a product of the Biden administration. Though not a paragon of virtue himself, George W. Bush has also condemned what happened on January 6th, along with Presidents Obama and Clinton. Nor is this point merely being made by presidents. Currently, Donald Trump faces not one, not two, but three lawsuits against him for his actions on January 6th. While not criminal in their approach, these suits are still incredibly important and could affirm the position of the Biden administration. And one of the judges in the case has shown an increased willingness to condemn Donald Trump's actions, or at the very least seems partial to hold Donald Trump responsible for what happened. And if that happens, all the more reason to bring attention to the issue. Donald Trump's rhetoric didn't just pollute the well of bipartisanship, or whatever you want to call it. It led to a violent attack on our Capitol, and 140-plus officers were injured as a result of his actions. His supporters, who trusted him, who believed in him, who put their well-being in his hands and in the hands of his lies, are now paying the price. Over 700 people have been arrested since the insurrection was carried out. So if anybody should be held accountable, it shouldn't just be the people who walked into this Capitol building and forced their way in. It's the man who lied to them in the first place and told them that they were saving the democracy that they love so much from enemies of the state, when in reality they were doing everything they could to destroy that very democracy. Speaking of January 6th, we now turn to the recent announcement that 11 members of the Oath Keepers militia, including their current leader, Stuart Rhodes, have been charged with seditious conspiracy for their involvement in the January 6th insurrection. In their indictment, the Justice Department wrote Rhodes and certain co-conspirators, to include selected regional leaders, planned to stop the lawful transfer of presidential power by January 20th, 2021, which included multiple ways to deploy force. They coordinated travel across the country to enter Washington, D.C., and equipped themselves with a variety of weapons, donned combat and tactical gear, and were prepared to answer Rhodes' call to take up arms at Rhodes' discretion, end quote. Current federal law allows the DOJ to charge two or more people who plan to, quote, overthrow, put down, or to destroy by force the government of the United States, or by force to prevent, hinder, or delay the execution of any law of the United States, or by force to seize, take, or possess any property of the United States. In other words, if you're intending to organize with somebody else an overthrow of the government or the destruction or seizure of its property, you can be charged with seditious conspiracy theory. This is the first time that said charge has been used since 1995, and it is fitting considering the damage that the attack did. More than 700 people have been charged for their involvement in the attack, of which 150 have pled guilty to those charges. And this is important not only because we should be seeing more discussions about cases like this, but because any evidence of planning helps push back on the nonsensical narrative that what happened on January 6th was not an insurrection. If it is planned, as the DOJ is alleging in this case, then that meets one of the legal requirements for saying that an insurrection took place. The second is that the people involved intend to overthrow the constitutional order of the United States. Now, I have heard the argument that the people who attacked the Capitol did not intend to overthrow the constitutional government of America, because the people involved believed they were saving it from a fraudulent election. But that argument is disingenuous, as it is a gross rewriting of history about what these rioters actually sought to do. They came there under the false pretense that the election was stolen, despite William Barr, Trump's own attorney general, demonstrating that that wasn't the case. They threatened to hang Trump's vice president because he wouldn't claim powers that the Constitution never provided to him. They were storming their political opponents' offices and made threats against the Speaker of the House. And they put a noose outside the Capitol building. And aside from the obvious violence, they also made serious attempts to actively support their party above their country. Consider the fact that nowhere in the riot did any of the members of the insurrection ever claim that the election was fraudulent in congressional races that Republicans won. They only claimed that the presidential election was fraudulent. But there's one problem with that. They're all on the same ballot. Presidential elections and congressional elections are run on the same ballot. You just go down the ballot when you vote. So when they were arguing that the election was stolen from Donald Trump, they were specifically saying that they had the power to determine who was and was not allowed to be president or in a position of authority under our constitutional order. They thought that they could dictate that despite not having any powers enumerated to them to do so under our current constitution. If that's not a usurpation of the Constitution of the United States, I don't know what is. There are always going to be people who keep making this argument that the insurrection was not what it obviously was, an attack on our democracy. And as more cases like this come forward, we the people need to keep the narrative on point, and we must do our best to remove the propaganda that the right spews from the public's attention, because it's just another group of lies hedged together in the defense of one man, Donald Trump. In some unfortunate legal news, the Supreme Court has blocked the Biden administration's vaccine and mask mandate for companies with over 100 workers. The decision handed down by the court means that the mandate, which would have been applied to 80 million workers, can no longer be enforced. There is, however, a caveat in that the Biden administration can simply still apply the rule to healthcare workers who receive federal funding. But beyond that, the Biden administration officially has its hands tied, and it is now a state-oriented response that could help end this pandemic. But more than that, this ruling represents one of my biggest problems with the Roberts Court. It is fundamentally a broken court and does not care about the practical implications of its rulings. At a time when 844,000 Americans have died from this virus and 5.5 million people have died globally, the consequences of a ruling like this are quite literally a matter of life and death. The court's argument in their ridiculous approach to what should have been a ruling for the administration is that the restriction goes beyond the purpose of OSHA and Congress's authorization. However, OSHA's fundamental purpose is to protect the workers from harm in the workplace. Despite the useless distinction that the court sets between mandating the people to be safe in public and being safe in their workplace, COVID still infects people regardless of whether or not they actually are at work. To put it another way, the court's argument is that by relying on requiring vaccination or masking, the mandate by OSHA goes beyond the workplace and therefore is an infringement not supported by Congress's original authorization when they created OSHA. But that distinction does not really apply or work in a pandemic. If you get infected at home, you can absolutely bring it to work. You could also be infected because your coworkers are not vaccinated. And even more than that, the mandate allowed exceptions, such as allowing people to provide a negative test to their employer to meet OSHA's guidance. And that is the problem. The court is creating an arbitrary distinction that the virus itself does not care about. To assert that they are protecting the original purpose of OSHA when there is nothing in the statutes to support that distinction is absurd. And I think Justice Kagan made this point best in her dissent when she wrote, quote, "Underlying everything else in this dispute is a single simple question. Who decides how much protection and of what kind American workers need from COVID-19? An agency with expertise in workplace health and safety, acting as Congress and the President authorized, or a court, lacking any knowledge of how to safeguard workplaces and insulated from responsibility for any damage it causes," unquote. And that complete insulation that the court has from ever facing any sort of consequences for their decision is exactly the problem in this case. There will never be any blowback for these decisions, no matter how many people it kills or how many variants come along, because the federal government can no longer do what states should have been doing the moment the vaccine was made available to the general public: mandating it. Now, I hope Republicans are happy with their pro-life judges, because from where I sit, I see a court is giving credence to a pundit class that has its hands drenched in blood. And no, I'm not being hyperbolic in this case, because from where I stand, I see a group of Republican pundits consistently lamenting vaccines, mask mandates, and any sort of precautions necessary to protect the American people. And then, when the Biden administration is forced to institute a mandate, when they much rather would have had all the vaccines be voluntary in the first place, because now a portion of the public, most of whom are Republican, refuse to get vaccinated voluntarily, a court instituted and controlled by Republicans gets in the way. How many more people have to die before the GOP and its legion of pundits realize that COVID is not done with us and the precautions that were instituted at the beginning of this are necessary now? Do we have to lose 1 million people? We are on track to do that right about now. All because the GOP convinced nearly a third of the population that they shouldn't get vaccinated despite it being life-saving. Only 63% of Americans are currently fully vaccinated, and if the death rate continues to go as it has, we may very well lose 1 million people. All I can say is that after this, I don't ever want to hear Republicans talk about them being the party of pro-life or the party of protecting human dignity, because there is none in this ruling. The GOP, as it stands right now, is the party of COVID denialists, and now it looks like they are the party of anti-vaccine propaganda and nut jobs. In perhaps what could be construed in lighter news, the RNC is considering removing itself from the presidential debate commissions that have previously run the debates for the last 30 years. Those of you who closely followed the 2020 election will know that Trump and the commission that runs the presidential debates have not exactly been on good terms. This was in part due to his caustic approach to Biden on the debate stage and his over-aggressive attempts to dominate said stage. But now that frustration has led the RNC to officially recommend a new policy requirement for all its future nominees for president. Under the proposed rule, no Republican nominee could participate in the presidential debates run by the current commission. Mind you, this commission has been running presidential election debates for decades and was founded by Democrats and Republicans. Strategically and thematically, this doesn't make sense. Moreover, the commission only deals with campaigns, not the national committees, and there is no guarantee that the Democratic Party would agree to any debate not handled by that commission. And this is the thing that doesn't make sense to me when I read stories like this. Yes, the Republicans have had complaints, such as the commission's aforementioned refusal to cooperate with the national parties, but the idea that the commission should be abandoned and replaced with some other bipartisan institution is absurd. Maybe it's because Republicans feel that their audience is already sold on the idea that the previous election was stolen, and that that comes with a certain distrust for institutions. But looking at this, I can't help but feel that this is just incredibly stupid. This is an institution that is not only freely available to you to get your presidential candidate out there and available to the public, but also lets you determine a platform to discuss policies. It allows you to put pressure on your other party if they don't like some of the rules surrounding the debate. That was one of the reasons Donald Trump looked so terrible when the commission was insisting on a virtual debate. So if Republicans were to actually pull out of the commission, it would make the Republican Party look as though it cannot handle rules set by a neutral arbiter. And that's not a good look to have going into the midterms, much less before an election in 2024. While it is unclear if the RNC will actually follow through, if they do, you can expect a very messy presidential cycle in 2024, and plenty of headlines to follow. We will be right back after this break. Stick around for more news from a progressive perspective. In foreign policy news, the talks between the United States and Russia have stymied despite attempts by the Biden administration to get the Russian government to withdraw its nearly 100,000 troops from the Ukrainian border. In an interview with CNN's State of the Union, Secretary of State Antony Blinken rejected Vladimir Putin's demands that NATO troops withdraw from Eastern Europe.
On these talks beginning tomorrow in Geneva, President Putin demanding that the U.S. pull some troops back out of Eastern Europe and rule out expanding NATO to include Ukraine. Are either of those on the negotiating table?
Neither of those is on the table, Jake, but here's where we are. There are two paths before us. There's a path of dialogue and diplomacy to try to resolve some of these differences and avoid a confrontation. The other path is confrontation and massive consequences for Russia if it renews its aggression on Ukraine. We're about to test the proposition about which path President Putin's prepared to take. We have important conversations between us starting tomorrow, as well as at NATO, as well as at the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe. We're going to listen to Russia's concerns. They're going to have to listen to our concerns. If they are proceeding in good faith, we think we can make progress in addressing concerns on both sides that would reduce tensions and deal with improving security. Mm-hmm. We'll do that in close coordination with European allies and partners. We've made very clear to Russia that there's going to be nothing about Europe without Europe. But ultimately, this is up to President Putin to decide which path he's going to follow.
While this interview was conducted prior to the meetings with NATO and Russia, we can now see that these talks have now seemingly failed. CNBC reports that the negotiations between the United States, NATO, and Russia have come to a halt with no compromise in sight. American officials such as National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan warned that Russia is, quote, laying the groundwork to have the option of fabricating a pretext for an invasion. End quote. And it is also worth noting that the Kremlin has previously forcibly annexed Ukrainian territory in Crimea in 2014, using illegal mercenaries and unmarked troops to do so. This is part of Russia's attempts to maintain control of Ukraine and its larger attempt to establish a sphere of influence in the absence of soft power that other countries have, allowing Russia to maintain itself as a global power as opposed to the regional power that it normally would be. To put this into context, in economic terms, Russia's current GDP is $1.4 trillion USD. Comparatively, Italy, which has consistently had economic trouble, has a GDP of $1.8 trillion per the World Bank. Compared to countries like France, which have a GDP of $2.63 trillion USD, Russia is consistently outmatched by most modern countries. So when it comes to influencing other countries beyond military force, Russia's abilities are actually quite limited, and that's why you see them reacting in this way. Their level of influence is dependent upon their military and coercive might. While Putin fails to adequately deal with his domestic problems, the only way he can maintain his control is by distracting the Russian public with a rally around the flag effect that usually comes with a war. Meaning that by waging a war, Putin can distract his people from the state of their country while simultaneously allowing the Russian people to have an enemy to blame for the problems within their country. And while it is unclear what Russia will do next, it is important to remember that the United States has threatened multiple sanctions against Putin and his administration should the invasion go forward. But so long as there isn't any action to stop any potential encroachment by Russian forces, Ukraine will still have their sovereignty threatened by an imperialistic power. And considering Russia just carried out a cyber attack against Ukraine, it seems increasingly likely that Russia isn't holding back this time and is going to expand its influence through force if necessary. In more historic news, the Washington Post has released an exclusive analysis of Congress and its relationship with slavery. Their findings show that over 1,700 people who served in Congress owned slaves. Among some of the more well-known members who owned slaves were Jefferson Davis, the eventual president of the Confederacy, Andrew Johnson, and many more. These slave owners represented up to 37 states through their time in the legislature. One of the senators, Senator Edward Lloyd of Maryland, enslaved 468 people on the very same estate where Frederick Douglass was enslaved, and he would not be the only person who was heavily influenced by the slave trade in his policymaking and in his personal life. Between 1789 and 1807, half of the Congress members were slave owners. Mind you, that was the first two decades of the United States government as established under the current Constitution. This is important not only as a matter of historical record, but also in terms of how we understand our government's relationship with the institution of chattel slavery, and really how we think of our country as a nation. If you have a country that had its laws from the very beginning being written by slave owners for the benefit of those same slave owners, that merits questioning the narrative of our country. That merits the narrative being questioned for any country. And unfortunately, this report will probably be brushed away by those who feel like this is just some past irrelevant thing. But the truth is, history matters regardless of what time period it took place in. History determines how not only do we see our predecessors, but how we see ourselves and how we proceed as actors in history in our own right. And I'll give you an example of that. When we talk about the Civil War, for example, a lot of the discussion surrounds the idea that the Union fought to end slavery, and there were some people who did that. But underlying that narrative is an ignorance about what was actually happening in the government, in the legislature. Even after Confederate states seceded, 20% of the members of Congress were either current slave owners or former slave owners, meaning people who had direct previous and continued connections to enslavement of people who had every right to be free. And even after the war, we still saw former slave owners, many of whom showed no regret for what they did, showing up in positions of power within the legislative branch. The first female senator was a slave owner. She showed no regret for the institution of slavery, and she was a noted white supremacist herself. So again, when we look at these analyses done by Washington Post or any other source that actively wants to look at the primary sources and the historical record, it needs to be taken seriously, and it deserves far more attention than it is going to receive in mainstream news. It'll be a controversy for a couple weeks. Maybe Ben Shapiro will respond to it and dismiss it as unimportant to the American narrative. But if there is any justice in recording history, more Americans will look at this report and come to terms with the fact that we were much more involved with the institution of slavery as a country and as a government than we previously would like to admit. And the sooner we realize that, the better off we will be. The fight over the filibuster has once again retained the attention of the news media and the public more generally. In a speech on Tuesday, President Biden endorsed a partial reform of the filibuster, arguing that voting rights legislation should not be blocked by the power of the filibuster or a few senators. In his speech, Biden explained his reasoning, saying, "Sadly, the United States Senate, designed to be the world's greatest deliberative body, has been rendered a shell of its former self," end quote. At times, Biden was emotional and drew upon the legacies of historical figures such as Dr. King and the late Congressman John Lewis, saying, "Do you want to be the side of Dr. King or George Wallace? Do you want to be on the side of John Lewis or Bull Connor? Do you want to be on the side of Abraham Lincoln or Jefferson Davis?" And while these words were powerful in their historical significance, they did not change the reality of the situation. While the filibuster has been a significant point of frustration with the Democratic Party and America more generally, it was clear that the two rogue senators, Kyrsten Sinema and Joe Manchin, would sink any effort to expand voting rights. Sinema specifically said she would not support any changes to the filibuster, but simultaneously said that she supported the John Lewis Civil Rights Act. And while I'm glad to see that the Biden administration finally acknowledges the damage that the filibuster does, it is too late now. Now that Sinema feels like she is in a good position to void any consequences from derailing her party for the next several years, because neither Biden nor other members of the Democratic Party have forced her to look at the long-term consequences of her decisions for her career. Sinema is up for re-election in 2024, long after the midterm elections, and long after Biden can afford to anger members of his party, since he will be running for president. And that is part of the reason why Biden's agenda will remain stuck until the Republicans either take control of the House or the Senate, where they will kill it. For a year now, progressives have been warning that the filibuster would be the silver bullet to any game-changing agenda that Biden proposed if there is no attempt to remove said filibuster. And lo and behold, the filibuster has effectively nullified the majority that Democrats worked so hard to gain in the first place. This isn't to say that this is entirely the fault of DNC leadership or members of the Senate leadership or even in the House. Much of the problem stems from corporate donors. In fact, part of the reason we're having so much trouble is because Manchin and Sinema are heavily influenced by their donors, more so than normal. A recent report by the New York Times found that Sinema and Manchin are receiving donor support from Wall Street billionaires precisely because of their opposition to Biden and his political agenda. Billionaire Wall Street investor Kenneth Langan, a longtime Republican donor who has not once donated to Manchin until recently, praised the West Virginian Senator for showing what he called guts and courage, and has promised to be one of the biggest fundraisers for Manchin. Sinema has received similar reports and support from Republican mega donors and corporate lobbyists. Republican mega donor Stanley Hubbard wrote a check to Sinema in September of just last year and has continued supporting her. She has also received nearly $500,000 from pharmaceutical companies and the financial services industry. Since she was elected, Sinema has received a minimum of $3 million from the corporate world. Drug makers have also donated large sums to support her work. Eggman CEO Robert Bradway gave her $5,000 in one donation. And while I have focused a lot on Sinema since she has no real political reason to act the way she does, both she and Manchin have seen their donations skyrocket thanks to their opposition to the Build Back Better platform of the Biden administration, despite the Biden and Sinema and Manchin being in the same party. So unless the Democrats can reorient their rules about donors, if they even care to, Democratic leadership won't be able to pressure Sinema or Manchin to change their behavior. Now, I don't want to sound defeatist, but considering we only have till November until the midterms, and Biden's approval rating hasn't improved lately, it is almost certain that Biden will face 2 years of radical Republicans in control of both the House and the Senate, all because of Sinema and Manchin. However, that doesn't mean there is nothing that can be done. Like I said earlier, Sinema is up for re-election in 2024, and so is Manchin. Democrats need to make plans to not only primary them, but actively to hold them accountable for the things they've done, to make them so unpopular that they become politically pointless to work with. Sinema should be heavily targeted since her home party is far less sympathetic to her actions than Manchin's party is to his. But still, if a primary challenge against Sinema is successful and Democrats manage to replace her, they can then focus on building a majority that would render Manchin irrelevant from 2024 onward. But even more than that, Democrats need to undergo a shift in their approach to politics. 48 Dems voted pretty consistently for Biden's agenda. Only two of them got in the way, and it is almost certainly because of their corporate donors. That has to be prevented from happening again. Democrats are going to have to find a way to restrict their colleagues from using right-wing funding sources and to be more accountable to their voters if they want the public's trust. They're going to need to prove that not only can they hold their party to account from within its own ranks, but they also have to prove that the American public can trust them with power to actually stop right-wing aggression within our legislatures and in our lives. And until that happens, nobody will trust the political system to reform itself. That's all for today's episode. Thank you all for joining me. If you enjoyed the show, consider checking out the newsletter at progressive-american.com. Thanks again for listening, and have a nice day.